This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, everybody out there waiting for our weekly podcast. I'm Simon Mayo.
And I'm Mark Kermode.
And it's slightly different this week because of the Chilcot Inquiry. There's a special like Chilcot mix. So when Tony Blair was at the Chilcot Inquiry, we just did a one-hour thing. Mm-hmm. And because it's Gordon Brown at the Chilcot Inquiry, it's another one-hour thing. I don't think there's anyone else important enough to take us off the air again.
No. The Chilcot Diversion, as it's being referred to.
Via the A36.
Yes.
So here comes our podcast this week with some very good reviews.
Yes.
Coming up.
Yep.
And a very interesting interview with Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass.
Unfortunately, if you're not watching it on the live stream, you're missing half the gag.
Here comes this week's podcast. Hello, everyone in the world. Good afternoon / good evening.
Yes. What day is it?
Welcome to a part two of the Chilcot Inquiry version of Wittertainment. So what is happening is, I know it's just turned 9 o'clock if you're listening to this on 5Live out of the radio. However, hello to everyone who's watching it online at 2:05.
Worn up whips at the ready.
Friday afternoon. So you have an alternative. Watch and listen to Gordon Brown explaining what happened, according to his version, in Iraq.
Here, very nicely done.
Very shortly, we're going to be offering you Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon with their version of what happened in Iraq and the search for weapons of mass destruction. Isn't that a strange thing?
Are they actually coming in?
Well, it's an interview that we recorded a couple of weeks back.
Oh, that's right. I was there, yeah.
But for those of you who are watching online, you can take part. So basically what this is we are recording a programme to be broadcast tonight, but you can watch us recording it. Mm. And if you are watching, there will be a visual treat as Matt Damon, did I audibly put inverted commas?
You did, yeah.
And Paul Greengrass will be here with us in the studio live.
Excellent.
As we interview them. That is merely moments away. Phil Illingworth, hello to the Fab 2. Just wanted to say thank you to Mark for kicking off my first visit to the bright lights and big city of London in ages for his celebrity appearance on the train. Throwing his money in the bin and then disappearing like a greased whippet into the underground the instant the doors open was definitely a star turn. Quite made up for the broken rail delaying the train and leading me to be one of those annoying people who are on conference calls on the train trying not to get funny looks from everyone else. Did you throw your money in a bin?
No, I carry my coins in a plastic bag. And
like
I was
a tramp?
Like a tramp. And I was trying to put the plastic bag in the thing and it split and it fell onto the top of the bin. This guy looked at me and I knew immediately that this happened. This was going to turn up on the radio. And as I put my hand in to grab it, the thing went down. It went in and he said to me, has anyone else put anything in there? And I said, I think we'll just leave it.
Do you sell the big issue on Wednesday?
I do, yes.
Dear Princess and the Frog, long-time listener, first-time emailer, love the show, Steve, listen to the podcast every week. I hadn't felt the need to email until a few weeks back when Simon suggested visiting New Zealand based on the quantity of Kiwi fan mail. Thought I'd let you guys know that we Shanghai listeners are also chuckling at Mark's celebrity impressions on a weekly basis. I feel a world tour.
I think so. I'd love to go to Shanghai.
Looking forward to Mark's review of Tim Burton's latest work, and this is from Quing Quing.
Very good.
I imagine that's Q-U-I-N-G, Q-U-I-N-G.
Quing Quing.
Quing Quing.
I would think so.
So Quing Quing, thank you very much indeed for the email.
Oh, blimey, Charlie, it's Matt Damon.
It's an online treat, though obviously
and
this
Paul
is
Greengrass.
Frustrating if you're listening in the evening because we've been joined in the studio by Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass, our own versions thereof. Dears Dr. Frankenstein and the Monster, very disappointed to find out that Extraordinary Measures was not a film in which Harrison Ford only referred to quantities of things in grains, quarts and square cubits. And that's from Dr. Keir Shields, MA, MB, Cantab, Royal Victoria Infirmary, Newcastle-upon-Tyne, future medical advisor to Benjamin Snittlegrass and the Cauldron of Penguins, more of which later.
Which seems to have taken on a life all of its own. It now has a trailer, not one but two posters, and a projected date, and a review. There's a review on YouTube.
So you can email mayo@bbc.co.uk. However, if you're listening to this after 9 o'clock, you can't.
No.
There is no point because we've gone home. So let's start then by talking about Green Zone. So Matt Damon, Paul Greengrass have this relationship based on the Bourne series of films that they've done together rather successfully.
Very successfully. I mean, after the Bourne series began without Paul Greengrass, he came in and sort of took it over and then they became very fabulous. There was talk about them doing another one, but instead they've done this, Green Zone, which effectively transports the action excitement of a Bourne film to a current political crisis.
Which you might have been hearing about on the news today.
If that's how current it is.
Now, Green Zone comes out next week. Mark and I caught up with Matt and Paul a couple of weeks ago. You were in Glasgow promoting your book, as you've been just relentlessly, week in, week out, day in, day out, forever. And I was hard work at Five Live Central. Now, you might remember that Paul Greengrass is a Crystal Palace fan who has, in the past, given me a whole lot of flack about Spurs not being fantastically successful. So, when Palace went into administration and were docked 10 points just before we spoke to Paul and Matt, we thought this would be an ideal moment to sort of get our own back.
Yes.
Really, I did brief you quite
well.
Yeah,
we should put out that the whole thing is because obviously I have no idea what the words I'm saying mean.
No, but I had explained to Mark exactly what's happened to Crystal Palace. So what we're going to do is we're going to play the tape of this interview, which we did a few weeks ago, and we'll play it right from the very beginning, and it's quite low level, but you can hear Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass coming into the room and then realising that it was Mark and me who were going to be doing the interview, so we were back talking about football and we were back talking about movies. So this is how it goes with Mark and me talking to Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass.
Wax cylinder.
That sounds like Greengrass.
Oh, Tottenham. Is this the one that we did?
Yeah.
I can hear it started already. It started. Is that Paul?
It is.
Have you got your friend Matt there?
Yeah, I'm here.
How you doing, Matt?
Terrific. How you doing?
I'm very good, and I could hear the abuse starting as you walked into the room. How nice was that? Hello,
it's
Paul.
It's good to see Liverpool in fourth place. I think that's how it'll stay till the end of the season.
I should mention Mark Kermode is with us, of course, from the Glasgow studio. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Paul. Hello Simon. Mark. Hello, Matt.
Can
I just
Mark.
Start? I just want to start by asking, do you think that the way that the film depicts the war is, it's kind of like a team going into administration and really not being able to because the 10-point thing down, I think there's a political parable in that, don't you?
Are you trying to tell me this is the Crystal Palace of big movies this summer?
Paul, far be it from me to say anything related to football, but do you think perhaps are you the Simon Jordan of the Hollywood world at the moment?
Is that? Oh no,
touché!
Oh, that is terrible. I think that's called revenge.
The Simon Jordan of Hollywood.
I'm going to have to leave now. I'll leave you with Matt.
No. Hey, well, it's good to have you both on the show again.
Great to be here. Great.
Matt, do you know what's going on here?
Yeah, I heard about Palace going into bankruptcy. That's terrible. Because they were finally going to make it back into the Premiership.
Is that what Paul was telling you?
Well, that's what. Yeah, those were the reports I was getting. Granted, they were coming through a filter.
Yeah.
I was getting my intel, my raw intel.
I was stovepiping it straight up.
My sources weren't vetted properly.
I can see what you're doing there. You're trying to take us back to the movie. Very good.
The thing you want to remember crucially is that the Championship should not be seen as a secondary division. It's more of a runner-up category, I think.
Cut to the quick. Hey, I should tell you, actually, do you get the Financial Times, Matt?
No, not regularly. I get it occasionally.
I read it cover to cover every day.
There's an advert in the FT today for the sale of Crystal Palace. Quote, an opportunity to acquire a long-established club, well-known brand and so on. Now is the moment, Paul. Come on. You and Matt, this is your next project. Crystal Palace, the movie.
Do you know what? This is absolutely true. I saw Terry Venables on Saturday and I said, Terry, can't you buy Palace and take us back up so like we were the team of the 80s? And he looked at me with such a look of, are you kidding me? It was like, you know then your club has no chance.
That's true. It does occur to me now that we really should be talking about Green Zone and not the merits of the Premiership versus the Championship and so on, especially when we have Matt with us. And it's very nice to have you both with us, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed. Take us through the general story for Green Zone for those who haven't seen any of the stuff, any of the story. They haven't read Imperial Life in the Emerald City. Between you, take it away. Tell us just the outline of this story that we're tackling here.
Well, it's an action thriller, and it's the story of an American, what they call a WMD hunter. They had these small teams that went across the border on the first night of the war, and their job was to go to sites that the intelligence packets had told them contained WMD, weapons of mass destruction. The story really is about one man who believes what he was told, as we all did, that the weapons were there, and when he gets there and he doesn't find them, starts to ask the question, I think in one way and another, we all ask, which is, hang on, how come they're not there? Who told us they were there?
Yeah.
And that leads him, like any great conspiracy thriller, into the most intense danger, the most deep and dark of conspiracy worlds, and ultimately towards, you know, a gripping action finale. I mean, that's the honest truth of it, but I think it's also another thing. It's when we were making the Bourne films together, the two that I made, I certainly felt that, particularly on Bourne Ultimatum, although they were sort of fictional stories about a, you know, an amnesiac assassin, there was this huge audience that loved the fact that they were incredibly close. They felt like they were ripped from the headlines, when in truth, of course, they weren't. They were entirely fictional stories. And for me, when we started to sort of plan Green Zone, it always felt to me like I wanted to make a film that was a broadly, you know, a film that a large audience would come to see set in that world, so that you could offer the audience that had enjoyed Bourne Ultimatum to take one step through the curtain, back into the real world, back to those unbelievably tense weeks before and after the invasion, to show that that's where it all comes from. That's where all that paranoia, intrigue and conspiracy comes from. And somewhere, that felt to me like the next step for me after Bourne Ultimatum.
Yeah. Matt, tell us about U.S. Army Chief Warrant Officer Roy Miller.
Well, as Paul said, he leads one of these mobile exploitation teams that went in and looked for these weapons. And he's based on a real guy named Monty Gonzalez, who worked on the film with us. And Monty actually led the Met Team Alpha in our movie. It's Met Team Delta. But he was racing, actually, the other team leaders and the other teams, because they were so sure they were going to find something. And, you know, they all wanted to be the first one to hold up the smoking gun on CNN, and was really kind of shocked and saddened to find that there was such a disconnect between what he had been told before he went in and what he actually saw as the reality. And in fact, and you know, when we find the guy in the story, he's already been to a few different sites and he keeps coming up empty-handed, and he's beginning to suspect that you know, something's not quite right. And in actuality, you know, Monty told me he knew the first factory that he went into that was listed as a dual-use facility, and he said there was no way they were making weapons there, and it was clear to him from the jump that he'd been given a bum steer.
So if your character is based on somebody who really existed, who had those experiences, and if, as Paul said, you were thinking about getting, you know, a mainstream audience to step into something which is more real, how much of the subsequent action of the film is based on actual events? Because it does play out, as Paul said at the beginning, like a thriller.
Well, like any great thriller, you start and then you go on a journey. And the truth is, the early scenes are very close to the sorts of things that happened to Monty. But as the story unfolds, you know, it's the story of a fictional character, Chief Miller, because he asks the question that I think in some inchoate way we all ask, which is, hang on, how did it go on? But of course, because it's a thriller, you want your hero to ask that question more and more pointedly, because that's going to drive him on a journey which is going to become both incredibly dangerous and incredibly action-filled, which is to find answers, you know. And so the answer to your question is, it's a fictional journey following a fictional hero through a very real landscape inhabited by the real issues and debates that were present. But he's intent on finding the answers and gets them. And those answers, that process of moving from, hang on, there's nothing here, what's gone wrong, to what happened, who told us they were there and why, and what was going on in the immediate, you know, immediately preceding the war, is a question that in a way has been present in our cultures, both in the UK and in the US, ever since that day. And it's taken us, I'm talking about us in the real world, you know, you, Mark, you, Simon, me, Matt, all of the listeners, it's taken us 5 or 6 years to reach that answer, broadly speaking, you know. So the film tries to tell in those few weeks the throe of the journey that all of us as citizens have been on, to try and find some resolution to how we got it all so wrong. And that's really what this movie is.
And there are differences between how this was handled in the UK and the US, but clearly implicit in your film, gentlemen, is the feeling, the overwhelming feeling that the press didn't really do the job that they should have done. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I would. You know, quite famously, you know, the New York Times basically came out and apologized for that after the fact. And that's something we touch on in the movie, that, you know, the press is represented in the movie by a character played by Amy Ryan. And so that is addressed. And their subsequent promise to get it right in the future is where that storyline kind of resolves itself.
I think that's very important, because bear in mind what I was saying about the journey. I think the journey from how do we get it all so wrong to broadly speaking understanding is one that encapsulates at the beginning a relationship between politics and the media which was not to the media's advantage. In other words, the kind of selective briefings that said, oh, you know, those are WMD there, we're going to find them. And there's no question, both in the UK and the US, that sort of stuff was reported way too credulously. But in the 5 or 6 years since, I think it's journalism based on testimony from the inside that has in large measure told us the truth about what really happened, as we're now finding in the Chilcot inquiry. So that's why at the end the movie ends as it is, because it's not just that the press didn't do their job. The truth is, in the years since, they've been at the forefront of exploring what went wrong.
There was a bizarre thing that Simon and I saw the film together and came out and got into a taxi and turned on the radio when the inquiry was going on. And it did seem to say that obviously this isn't a historical story. This is a story which is still playing out even as we're watching the film.
Yeah, and I think that's indicative of what I'm saying. I think that it's a film whose time has actually come. I think we're ready now to draw the line on that thing and come to a final reckoning. And in many ways, you know, journalists write the journalistic stories and historians will write the history and the Chilcot Inquiry will do the Chilcot Inquiring. But the fact that you've got movies now, like Green Zone, you know, Hurt Locker, all these movies that are exploring, it's that thing that we saw in Vietnam. There comes a point where people are ready to go and see these pieces, and you know, we always wanted to make a piece that a broad audience would find rewarding. And that means, obviously, a first-rate, top-of-the-line action thriller. You know, that's what you've got to craft in order to deal with the beef at the heart of it.
And so much to enjoy in the film, including Jason Isaacs' Village People-style moustache. That was a charmer, wasn't it?
It was a hell of a mustache, but to Jason's credit, one of the special forces guys who worked security for the set while we were shooting had that exact mustache. So literally that exact mustache. It was as if Jason had taken the mustache off of his face and put it on his own. So it was authentic, which was always Jason's kind of first All of his energy went into authenticity.
It was a particular thrill to see the credit at the end and Jason Isaacs. I mean, I thought that was as close as you got to saying "and hello" to Jason Isaacs as I've ever actually seen on a movie credit. Very good.
He's a great bad guy, isn't he?
He is.
He is fantastic. And we just need to ask the question, which of course nobody else is asking you, Paul. You've made it clear you're not doing a Bourne film. Matt, I don't another one. And Matt, I don't think you have done. What can you tell us about that?
No, I've made it clear that I'm not doing it without Paul. I don't think I could make any clearer about that. But I'm not saying that there never will ever be one. But there certainly won't be one now.
Didn't you say you're not done with the character yet?
Well, look, that's how I've always felt, and I've always said that, and I'd love to do another one, but it doesn't feel like we have a story to tell right now. That, you know, and people stop me on the street all the time, and there's definitely an appetite for it, and people, I think, would like to see another one. But I think it's more a matter of finding a story that really works, and Paul and I both have other movies that we want to do now, and you know, so I it's also to be perfectly honest, it's not a franchise that would suffer really from taking a little break. On the contrary, I think it actually might help it.
I still think my idea about the Crystal Palace movie, or Crystal City, as Mark keeps on calling it,
the Bourne Palace. I would return for that. But the truth is, just going back on that Bourne thing, it's one of those issues where I just felt I needed to go off and do some other films. And the problem with this is that you're in the area of contradiction between, you know, the need to service a franchise and the need that individuals have, say me or Matt, to make other things. And in the end, I mean, it was said that I had a big row with the studio. It's actually not true. They were actually very decent about it. You just come to a point, you say to them, do you know what? I know what it is you want, but I can't do it. I need to go off and do some other things. And, you know, maybe we'll return to Bourne one day, but it's not sort of front of our agenda at the moment. And that, you know, they face that problem on numerous franchises. Before.
I think the Bourne bankruptcy would be a great title.
starring Matt Damon and Simon Jordan?
Exactly.
I love that.
Paul and Matt, fantastic to speak to you again, gentlemen. Thanks very much.
All right, guys. Bye.
And that was Matt Damon, Paul Greengrass speaking just a couple of weeks ago. An online treat. As we had a characterization being... A reenactment. Exactly what was happening.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they always have to say on Crime Watch, isn't it?
Yes.
Reenactment.
Stephen in Loughborough. What have I been smoking? This is the weirdest bit of radio I have ever seen. Rachel in Coventry. I spat tea over my computer when Paul and Matt came into the studio. Paul Greengrass, a lot of people saying this, looks an awful lot like James May. That was probably just the way we made him. Big shaggy hair. Dominic Holmes, dear Garnish with Mayo, depending on when listeners hear this, should you read it out, I try to cater to all time frames. I was at work this afternoon and will be was unable to view, listen to the 2 p.m, 9 p.m. show, which I'll miss anyway, as I will be, in the studio watching Alice in Wonderland in 3D, which isn't in 3D, because I will be, using the specially made Kermode 2D specials.
Fantastic. The rectifying glasses.
Thank you for your time. Whether it be light outside or dark outside. To the podcasters, you really should have been listening live anyway. Now, look, we've got 3.5 minutes before...
Should we do the top 10 in 3.5 minutes?
We're going to take a break for the news.
Yeah.
Okay. Obviously, if you're listening and watching this afternoon, we're just going to sit around for 5 minutes and discuss things.
Tough.
So, box office top 10, and then all the reviews coming up in the second half of our Chilcot Inquiry, specially shortened edition.
And we'll try and get through Alice in Wonderland, Legion, Case 39 and Ondine, but we're not going to do that if we don't get on with the top 10.
At number 10, Invictus.
Enjoyed the rugby. Matt Damon was great in that as well. Actually the best thing in it.
A Single Man at number 9.
Very, very strong performance by Colin Firth. I think he's going to have a hard job beating Jeff Bridges at the Oscar, but I like him very much, and I do think that Tom Ford did a much better job than people are giving him credit for.
Dear Horace and Doris, says Brian, having heard your review of A Single Man, an interview with Colin Firth, I was not surprised by the lead character's meticulous approach to getting ready in the morning, albeit with the aid of a maid. However, I could instantly tell he was going to encounter some extreme misfortune. Why? Well, he did insist on placing his shoes on the dressing table. As any old wife knows, this is extremely bad luck.
Yep.
If his maid had moved the shoes, the film could have had a happy ending.
It's almost as bad as putting your hat on a bed, isn't it?
And in homage to Slumdog, is it the feel-bad movie of 2010?
Very good.
From Paris with Love at 8.
Gun-toting nonsense and boring.
And quite extraordinarily, Leap Year at number 7.
One of the least fun things I have done in living memory. One laugh, the laugh came from the repetition of the word poo. But if, as I said before, if you stay at home and say the word poo twice, that'll be more fun than sitting through Leap Year. And you were there, Simon. Did you laugh? No, you didn't. You didn't.
Did I chortle?
No, you didn't. You slightly guffed at one point. I didn't mean that.
Right. Valentine's, so you've got Leap Year at 7 and Valentine's Day, these two seasonal products hanging around.
Like a
six.
Hallmark card full of sick arriving through your letterbox.
Percy Jackson, Benjamin Snidelgrass, the Olympians, The Lightning Thief and the Cauldron of Penguins, all at number 5. You've got a voiceover, by the way, to add.
Do I need to read this out?
Yeah, because this has now been added. There are trailers, but it hasn't got a voiceover. So if you could just do that.
Okay. You serious? Okay.
Yeah, okay.
In a world in which narrative coherence is under threat, it takes a real hero not to lose the plot. And in a world in which holding on to a penguin could mean holding on to the woman you love, one boy better make sure he doesn't lose the pot. This summer, make sure you don't fall... This summer, make sure you don't fail to miss the cinema event of the afternoon, Benjamin Snidelgrass and the Cauldron of Penguins. The magic has yet to begin.
You see, what's interesting about that voice is that it only lasts for a sentence, and then it kind of tires.
Becomes boring.
Hey, let's.
But you asked me to do it.
The Princess and the Frog at 4.
I like it very much. Old-fashioned animation with good drawing.
The Crazies at 3.
Not quite the political parable that the original Romero was, but still pretty good fun and cranked up nihilism a go-go.
Cranked up nihilism a go-go. 30
seconds.
Put it on the poster. The Lovely Bones at 2.
An adventurous but ultimately failed endeavour. Problem is, heaven looks like Super Mario Galaxy, which is never a good thing, but Saoirse Ronan is really terrific.
And quite extraordinarily, in the same way that Bryan Adams just got to number one and didn't move, Avatar is still number one.
The pointy birds are pointy, pointy. Anoint my head. Anointy-nointy.
Hasn't everyone seen it now? You would have thought. Everyone's maybe gone to see it.
Going again.
Okay, so that's the box office top 10. Boy, that was quick. We brought you an interview. Coming next, the reviews of the movies which are out this weekend.
BBC Radio 5 Live is also available through your digital TV. Sky, Freeview, Freesat and Virgin Media are just some of the ways you can listen.
As well as on medium wave. But you can't say that anymore.
No, I know.
So welcome back. So
it's a radio station.
It's a special Chilcot Inquiry version of Wittertainment, whereby it's Friday evening, for example. Although if you're watching online, it's Friday afternoon at 25 minutes to 3. If you're listening to this in the evening, you cannot email, you cannot text. Do not take part, because we're all done and dusted and out of here and going to hit parties. That's what we do on a Friday night.
That is what we do, yes.
But if you're watching, then you can email. You can send us an email now, mayo@bbc.co.uk. Jason Isaacs is going to be on the programme next week, by the way. Hello to Jason.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
To talk further about Green Zone. And hello to David and to Stephen and to Fairport and all the other, and Focus.
And can I just say, there are some other people that I need to say hello to, but I'll do it next week when we do the proper show, because I've failed to bring the emails in.
Chris... Lily, just on this. Back in the old days, son, when multiple screens first arrived in Kent, my local cinema had a tiny screen, the Asoldo 3, that alternated soft porn and art house. On one of the
art house
weeks...
It's often so hard to tell the difference, isn't it?
On one of the art house weeks, I watched the film jam in the projector, because there's lots of projectionist email coming in after your love for projectionists last week.
I thought you meant I watched the film Jam in the Projector. It's like an art house movie called Jam in the Projector.
No, the film got jammed in the projector. It then melted excitingly and then bloomed into flame. No one did anything. So I wandered through a door marked private and informed the poor wretch working three projectors on his own that the film in screen 3 was actually on fire, and watched him trying to save Milos Forman's The Fireman's Ball from a celluloid inferno and failing.
Did you know that that's why film censorship fell under the remit of local councils? Because councils were given the right to govern what went into cinemas and what was dangerous, not because they thought that the images could corrupt people, but because film was highly flammable, which is why to this day, historically, the control of cinemas, rather than being totally under the remit of the BBFC, it has gone down through local councils, because it's a fire hazard.
To the review desk.
Okay.
What's new?
Alice in Wonderland, the Tim Burton movie, long awaited. 19-year-old Alice returns to the land which has haunted her dreams. And she finds that she doesn't remember it. And all the things that happened to her that happened sort of in Alice in Wonderland, like you have to drink the potion, you have to eat the cake, you have to go through the thing. Voices keep saying, why doesn't she remember? Why doesn't she remember? She ends up in Wonderland, which she kind of vaguely has a memory of, but of course it's not Wonderland, it's Underland. And she has returned to it, but she's forgotten it. And she meets all the old characters who she kind of remembers, but she doesn't remember, but she sort of does, including the cat. Here's a clip.
It looks like you ran afoul of something with wicked claws.
But I'm still dreaming.
What did that to you?
Banner or bandits.
The Bandersnatch? Well, I'd better have a look.
What are you doing?
It needs to be purified by someone with evaporating skills, or it will fester and putrefy.
I'd rather you didn't. I'll be fine as soon as I wake up.
At least let me bind it for you. What do you call yourself?
Alice.
The Alice?
There's been some debate about that.
I never get involved in politics.
So,
would that be Stephen Fry?
It would be.
Hello, Stephen.
And lots of other famous people in the cast. Helena Bonham Carter, obviously, as the Red Queen.
How did she get the job?
I have no idea. Actually, because she's brilliant, except for the fact that she plays the Red Queen... But she plays it pretty much, and I'm not the first person to say this, as Miranda Richardson doing Queenie out of Blackadder. It's very odd how uncanny, because people have talked, for example, about the fact that the Anne Hathaway character, the White Queen, it was theoretically inspired by Nigella Lawson, because Tim Burton in an interview in America said, oh, there's this woman on television, and she's, you know, she's great, and she also has this kind of glint that's sort of strange, and it's Nigella Lawson, which, fine, yes, but on the other hand, there is definitely the, you know, the Queenie character from Blackadder.
Unusual TV reference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a reference. I think it's a straight lift, actually. Crispin Glover and Matt Lucas and Michael Sheen and Alan Rickman and Barbara, basically star-studded cast. Now, I went in quite enthusiastic because I'm a very big Tim Burton fan. I quite like the idea of you sort of return to the material. I mean, the character has grown up a little bit, but has sort of got a memory of the stuff that's happened before, but sort of doesn't. And so there's that kind of, you know, through a glass darkly. And it sounded to me like a very interesting idea. I have to say, in the end, it ended up like watching a load of bits of Tim Burton's stuff which didn't come together in the way that it ought to have done. And the perfect image for this for me was at one point going when they're walking through some woods and there are trees and all the trees have got those kind of strange, curly... You know the way in which Tim Burton branches curl around on themselves like somebody with a wax moustache? It's a very particular form of curling that Tim Burton designed.
I want one
does.
Of those moustaches next week.
But, you know, fine, you have one of them and I have the handlebar one. You know what I mean? And so all the way through, you think the design is very Burton-esque and yet... It doesn't have, for a start, it doesn't have the substance of something like Edward Scissorhands. There's, at the centre of it, you have this performance by Johnny Depp, who's kind of doing the Mad Hatter character in a way, two different accents, one of them sort of lisping British, one of them sort of broadly Shrek-like Scottish, and doing very much what he did with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, with the Willy Wonka character, of playing it, you know, in this kind of very pastiche-y, overwrought way that's kind of all right but kind of doesn't quite work. And then you have the 3D issue, that the whole film was shot against green screen and then retrofitted into 3D, which is something you do, you know, afterwards in the computer. And quite apart from my ongoing problem with 3D, which I remain more convinced about.
You must tell us more about that.
I must tell you more about it, but at the risk of boring
everybody. I'm quite new to that.
Let me just say... Let me just say, if you're going to see it, you know, go see it in 2D, because the 3D doesn't add anything. It does look like it's kind of bolt-on. Actually, funnily enough, the thing that some people have said about it is, well, the thing that's really good about the 3D is you don't notice it's in 3D. You go, yeah, well, then in that case, don't do it in 3D. It's a very... strangely disappointing movie, because all the constituent elements are interesting. So I kept thinking, I wonder what, you know, if you were a young viewer, somebody looking for, you know, you'd seen versions of Alice before, would this have more resonance than it had for me? I mean, I think in the end, you know, 12-year-old kids will probably quite enjoy it. It's a PG certificate movie, but it's just, it does not hang together for all its visual artistry, for all its invention, for all the fact that I like Tim Burton and I want to like the movie more. It looks like a holding pattern movie. It looks like the movie that you make between projects that you actually really wanted to do. Despite how much Tim Burton has talked about how much he wanted to do Alice, it didn't look like a fully fledged movie. What it looked like was a venture that Tim Burton happened to have helmed, but it didn't look like an organic Tim Burton project to me. And in the end, it disappointed me.
Dr. Rob Jane, BSc, PhD.
Yes.
Dear Dr. Ination and Dr. Inair, as in doctrination, I suppose.
Yeah, I get it.
Doctrinaire. This is groundbreaking radio live streaming recording interview technology. You guys should reenact other famous film-based interviews. How about Frost Nixon? Do you think we could do that in the kind of Greengrass Damon?
Well, only if I could do Nixon, because I already look like Nixon, or Ed Sullivan, apparently. I gave Duncan Jones the award for Best Director at the Kermodes, and apparently there's a thing on his Twitter things which says it's great, and the statue is a dead ringer for Ed Sullivan.
Kenneth says, definitely where the comedy tashes next week. Stalin for Mayo, Groucho for Kermode. Jason Isaacs isn't listening.
I love the idea of you as Stalin.
Well, I quite like that.
Stalin
idea.
Wasn't stalling when he told the beasts of Berlin that they'd never... Never mind.
What?
Stalin wasn't stalling.
What?
Robert Wyatt did a version of it.
So?
Well, I didn't mention
Thank
it.
You. Mark in Middlesbrough, dear Handlebar and Toothbrush. Yes, comedy moustaches are needed for next week's live stream. Tuning in for the first time online and enjoying it immensely. Going to see Alice in Wonderland in 3D tonight in the sole interest of seeing the new Doctor Who trailer on the big screen.
Oh, right,
Looking forward to the review, bristling with anticipation.
I didn't get to see the Doctor Who trailer. That's a disappointment.
That's a great way of promoting it.
It is, yeah. I would go and see the Doctor Who trailer.
Matt in Durham, dear Kevin and Doug. I know Dr. Mark usually refers to the BBFC for a witty comment, but this week... they have been outdone by the MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America. Yeah. The BBFC gave Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland a PG certificate for moderate fantasy violence. However, the MPAA have given Alice in Wonderland a PG certificate for, quote, fantasy action violence involving scary images and situations and for a smoking caterpillar. That's a quote. Do they think a smoking caterpillar is too much for some to handle? Or does a smoking caterpillar...
They think
caterpillar...
it's imitative. That's what they think. They think kids will go, I saw that caterpillar smoking and it looked really good.
I'm going to have one. Or does a smoking caterpillar automatically warrant a PG certificate on some obscure insect smoking scale? After all, the MPAA rated Avatar PG-13 for... And some smoking, not some images of Sigourney Weaver smoking. So that is astonishing. Yeah. Because there's a smoking caterpillar, give it a PG.
May I remind you that there is on the BBFC website for the classification for Team America, it says rated 15 for swearing, whatever it is, and scenes of puppet sex.
That is quite funny.
It is quite funny. Can we do Legion?
But laughing in a kind of in an internal way. Now, Legion's the new Paul Bettany film.
Legion's the new
Therefore,
Paul Bettany
you
film.
You walked into this wanting to like it and loving Paul
I
Bettany.
I tripped my way up. Because for a start, I'd seen the poster, which is Paul Bettany with his shirt off and a pair of wings looking up in the air, the word Legion. Okay, so I thought, it doesn't matter what happens, I'm on. So the story is, in a remote diner, a pregnant waitress is serving a bunch of customers, including a family who are in the middle of a squabble. Dennis Quaid, who is her boss, who keeps bashing the telly because the signal's going because something bad is happening outside. Charles Dutton is the Vietnam veteran who's cooking the burgers. And along comes this enigmatic figure. Can it be? Yes, it certainly is. Paul Bettany, because the apocalypse is coming and he's ahead of the wave.
The last time God lost faith in man, he sent a flood. This time he sent what you see outside.
Are you saying this is the apocalypse?
I'm saying this is an extermination. Those things outside are just vessels. They're possessed. The weakest willed are the easiest to turn.
Possessed by what? Demons?
No. No. By angels.
Hold on. How do you know so much about them?
Because until last night, I was on their side.
Don't you just love the sound of Paul Bettany doing
yes,
that
Yes, I do. I also like the prospect of, you know, the apocalypse being heralded by Paul Bettany wandering into a calf.
But it's not just Paul Bettany, right? It's Paul Bettany with machine guns. It is angels with Uzis, okay?
And dirty faces.
And dirty faces. Now, obviously, you have to do this first because you have to state all the movies to which Legion owes a debt, okay? So clearly, Legion, the biggest debt it owes to is Legion, the film which ended up being Exorcist 3, which has a sequence in it in which an old woman called Mrs. Clalia scuttles up a wall and across a ceiling like a bug. And that sequence is actually reproduced in Legion, in one of the scariest sequences in Legion, in fact. One of these which suddenly an old woman goes completely mad. So that's clearly a rip-off from the original Legion. There's a lot of references to a film called Screamers, which was very, very little seen, with these big open mouth shouting stuff, which is clear. To some extent you can see a bit of End of Days in it, the idea that about the only way to fight the devil is to get out an Uzi and shoot everything in sight. There's, well, Dogma.
Is that not right?
Apparently not. I mean, I would have gone for crucifixes and holy water, but apparently the chosen weapon of choice nowadays... Christopher Walken may say that love is his weapon of choice, but the fact is... Actually, funnily enough, there is a Christopher Walken movie in the back of all this as well called Prophecy. Do you remember that? When Christopher Walken was the angel Gabriel? Hey, Gabriel, you know, God, you said it with... You remember that? Did you never see that?
It's all flooding back. No.
Yeah, Michael, you'd go, God, he's annoyed. Have you seen the thing of Eddie Izzard doing Christopher Walken doing Macbeth? Macbeth, your wife. Yeah, she's crazy. Anyway, but...
Your impressions are just
They all sound exactly
now.
The same. I'm terribly sorry. Okay, so there's definitely that in the back of it. Viggo Mortensen as Lucifer in that.
I'm hoping that we get to do Case 39, because I want to know whether your Renny Zellweger is going to be exactly the same.
Okay, it will be exactly the same. There's definitely some of the omen. I was thinking about this, okay, because the whole story is that what has to happen is that Paul Bettany is there in order to protect the pregnant waitress, because the pregnant waitress has within her womb the child that will save the world. So there's a kind of Children of Men thing going on, but it's also like The Omen backwards, which I figured out halfway through the movie is The Omen backwards is Nemo, which made me laugh. But so there are, if you have seen any of these films before, you will just sit there going, yeah, that's from that, that's from that, that's from that, that's from that. In fact, is it Dogma in which you have the angels that have hacked their wings off? Because Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, have they hacked their wings off in Dogma? Because I've seen another, but I'm trying to remember what it
just
is.
Just remember Alanis Morissette as God.
As God doing the cartwheels, yeah. I can't remember which movie it is, text in which the angels have hacked their wings off.
You can't text in, because if you text in, that's the Chilcot Inquiry comment.
Oh, fine. Don't
you can email.
I would, however, like the Chilcot Inquiry comment to have the bit in which the angels hacked their wings off was, in fact, done. Anyway,
we'll have the answer, please, if you're watching online and it's 12 minutes to 3. Fine. But if you're listening tonight and it's 12 minutes to 10, please don't, because we're not here. We're not here. With famous people.
You remember the word that you coined last week?
Wash.
Wash. Okay.
Combination of wow and tosh.
Well, Legion, I'm sorry. I mean, obviously not the wow factor of Avatar, because whatever else is wrong with Avatar, it does have wow factor. I smiled, laughed, giggled, chortled, just beamed all the way through Legion. It is stupid as sin. It is Dumbo in ways you can't begin to imagine. It makes no sense whatsoever. People shoot things and then stop to have theological arguments. And there is at the heart of it, and in inverted commas, theological argument about if God's wrong, is it wrong to go against God? And do you need to... And...
Yes.
Do you need to... Is it wrong?
What?
Well, you said yes, like that was... Like that you were suddenly doing Father Mayer. Was that right? Is it wrong? If God's wrong, is it wrong to go against God?
Can I come back to... Can I text you the answer on that?
And the other thing that it does is that fantastic... Do we give God what he asks for? Or do we give God what he needs? Now, when I saw the film, I saw Father Peter Malone was there, who I'm a very, very big friends with. Lovely guy, really, really smart guy.
So we can judge what God needs, can we? If you ask for something, you're just going to get it.
Yeah, Simon, it's a stupid film in which angels carry Uzis. And I did ask Father Peter afterwards whether he thought that it had theological substance, and the noise that he made wasn't particularly verbal. I mean, obviously, it is complete hooey, hogwash, baloney, all the rest of it. But Paul Bettany carries it shoulder high. The supporting performances are actually more fun than you'd think they were. It's total tripe and idiotic in, you know, totally interstellar ways. But I was never bored, and every moment Paul Bettany he takes his shirt off quite a lot, which is quite good, and he does that Paul Bettany thing, which is that he puts his head down, he looks out from under the brow of his eyes, and then he says something. I can't do Paul Bettany, obviously, and then he says something.
Paul Bettany sound like all your
other voices. Rennie Zellweger like that, and it, sorry, laughed all the way through, enjoyed myself, a pathetic guilty treat.
Stupid as sin was new. It's usually stupid as nuts, isn't it?
Oh, okay. But yeah, but in this biblical context, stupid as sin sounded right. Should we move on to case 39? I'm just aware that I don't want time to fly by because I'm trying to get through stuff. Do you want to say anything else about Paul Bettany?
He's great. It's 10 to 3. It's 10 to 10. Let's move on.
Case 39, a horror thriller starring Renee Zellweger. And Renee Zellweger is a social worker. Meg Ryan is a helicopter pilot. Reeves.
Well, I can imagine Renee Zellweger is closer to a social worker than Meg Ryan was ever
to a
helicopter pilot.
Okay.
Don't you think?
No, but you're more
carry on. I haven't seen Case 39.
Okay, so she's a high-powered social worker. Basically, what she does is, she's a social worker. And she goes to a family, and she sees that the parents are bonkers. And the parents have a young girl who's clearly in danger from the parents. And she goes to the authorities and goes, oh, it's terrible. The parents are going to do something terrible to the young girl, but the authorities won't listen because there's the usual, you know, phony, bony, you know, stuff in movies. Oh, we can't do anything because of this. Then the parents attempt to put the daughter in the oven, in what can only be a reference to a Grimm's fairy tale. In an action sequence, Renee and her friends break in and save the child, right, from the mad parents. And Renee then, despite saying, it is impossible for me now to adopt you, since I'm somebody involved in the case which has freed you from the terrible people that were looking after you before, manages to adopt said child, at least temporarily, and then really bad stuff starts to happen. Here's a clip.
There's no laws against being weird, Em.
I didn't say weird. I said scary. That man sat there staring at me the whole time, and the mother is his emotional slave.
Wait, you didn't just fly to New York and meet with my parents, did you?
Wayne?
All right. Are there any cuts, any bruises, any signs she's being abused?
No, not physically. But this girl's in trouble, and I can feel it.
You want to know what I can feel? The lawsuit we're going to get hit with if we violate her parents' rights without any evidence they've done something wrong.
All right, Wayne. You put these files on my desk and you ask me to tell you what's going on. I've told you. I've done my job. What you do with it is yours.
Interestingly, not the clip I thought we were going to play. It doesn't make any difference. It sets up the whole...
What bit did you think we were going to
have? The bit afterwards when she says, oh, I've adopted her and now things are going terribly badly wrong. And she doesn't say it in that voice. Now, as we walked out of this screening...
It was almost Danny Dyer there for a moment.
As we walked out of this screening, somebody said to me, I will be offended if you don't use the phrase paedophobic tract in reviewing this, because of course that is the phrase that I have used before, and it is definitively paedophobic tract. Paedophobia as in fear of children, you know, whole theme of horror for a very long time, fear of children. When you go back to, you know, The Others or Turn the Screw, or Exorcist, Omen, Rosemary's Baby, all that sort of stuff, films in which children scary, okay? So what you have at the centre of this is the idea that child in danger from parents, child saved from parents, child taken from somebody, suddenly realise that actually maybe it's the child that's the danger. And this is a very, very well-worked horror riff. And what you're seeing here is not something that's profoundly original. In fact, this must have been around for a while because the guy who made it, Christian Albert, he's made another film since then. Pandora has been released since then. And all the press reports about it being made were like 2008, 2000. And the girl who's in it, the main girl, is the girl out of, the girl who plays Lilith, is the girl out of Terry Gilliam's Tideland and doesn't look substantially to have grown up since Tideland. So it's been on a shelf for a while, essentially. And one can kind of see why, because in a way it is straight to video fodder. I mean, it is functional nuts and bolts straight to video fodder, given a little bit of a boost by the fact that your central child player there is actually very good and that Renee Zellweger is a huge big star. Although I'd struggle to see exactly what it was that Renee Zellweger saw in the project and thought, well, that's what I need to kind of broaden my palette. That said, do you see how I did that? That
Jimmy Savile moving
Jodelle Ferland, that's the woman, that's the girl's name, Jodelle Ferland, who was really, really great in Tideland, is clearly a very good actress. And you know, and then Ian McShane, who just chews the scenery up. Ian McShane does the kind of the gruff partner stuff, and you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, oh well, let's do it anyway. It obviously makes no sense whatsoever, and it kind of cops out sort of towards the ending. But if you saw it at home of a Friday night as a straight-to-video title that Renee Zellweger happened to have made before she became Renee Zellweger, and let's not forget that Renee Zellweger began her career making...
Oh, some old tosh.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4.
I know what I meant.
In which she co-starred with Matthew Mahogany. Hang on, I haven't finished. Oh. It is rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, it is rubbish, and it's nothing like as much fun as Legion, and it's very old hat, and it's easy to see why it sat around the shelf for a long time. But there are moments in it when, because of that kid, because Jodelle Ferland is, you know, is quite good at doing the "Mommy, Mommy, you need to do what I say now, or bad things will happen." She does that quite well.
Jack Gregson, dear sirs, I was unlucky enough to win free tickets to what I can easily call the worst film I've seen in a very long time.
It's not that.
Case 39, with its odd jump scares that barely relate to the movie, bizarre plot twists that are unexplained and rather predictable, and its hammy acting, this surely has to be a contender for worst film of the year, and at the moment, the decade. I thought it was lucky at one point during a climactic scene when the projector just stopped playing the film. I thought that this must be the ending, and there are no credits on the film, as everyone involved was too thoroughly ashamed of themselves to put their names on it. Unfortunately, the film started up again, and I got to see the abysmal ending. This poor rip-off of last year's Orphan, which wasn't that good in the first place, deserved to go straight to DVD, and that, says Jack Gregson, is coming from a Zellweger fan.
But that, exactly what I mean, it is a straight-to-DVD title. It's not a proper... I mean, it is... If you'd seen it on a... bear in mind, I used to do the Sight & Sound DVD column, and you get through an awful lot of, you know, Greg Dark... what they used to call suspense in suspenders movies, in which, you know, people like Delia Shepherd would run around with a gun for half an hour for no good reason, except it's a straight-to-video. So
a gun and suspenders?
Yeah. That's just how it...
Do you think that's ever happened?
In real life?
Yeah, no. In real life, that there's been someone running around with a machine gun intending to use it and been wearing suspenders.
Ed Wood, perhaps, because he apparently parachuted over Germany in World War II wearing women's pants. No, I don't think so.
This is the post-water show. Just as well it's after 9 o'clock.
Can we do Undine quickly?
Undine, yes.
It's okay, so it's rubbish, but it's not certainly not. It's certainly not going to appear in my worst 10 of the year. Not by quite some distance.
Are we talking about Undine?
Undine.
And now it's Undine.
The new Neil Jordan movie. Okay, you know Neil Jordan.
I do know Neil Jordan.
Michael Collins, Butcher Boy, Crying Game, all that sort of stuff. So have we got time for a clip? I think we have.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Colin Farrell, fisherman. Yeah, one day goes out fishing, pulls up his net. In it. It's a woman, right?
What, in the net?
In the net, yeah. Blimey.
Who'd have thought it?
She looks dead, but he resuscitates her, takes her back to his little picturesque cottage. His daughter, from whom he is estranged because he's separated from the daughter's mother, says, you know what? She's a Selkie. You know? Selkie.
Mermaid?
Well, no, Selkie. Sort of mermaid. More seal-like.
What's the difference?
Well...
Half mermaid, half seal.
Yes, exactly.
It's not a lot, is it?
She goes out fishing with him. She sings songs to catch the fish. Here's a clip.
Potter didn't want to be seen.
He can hide again.
And it's bad luck.
A girl on a boat.
For the fishing.
Have you been having good luck lately?
No. Okay then. Get in.
Oh.
was that song you were singing?
Just a song.
Well, do you remember it?
Must have.
Do you remember your name?
You can call me Undine.
That's nice. What's it mean?
She came from the water.
Now, just hold up. There's a line there where she says, "What's that song?" He says, "What's that song you're singing?" Yeah. And everyone else is going, "Well, hang on, guitar player. What's that tune you're picking? That Diddly Eye theme sounds very familiar to me."
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It is. It's
Mark Knopfler.
It is. I mean, it's terrible because it's so do 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 do. Oh no, we're not going to play that. But then she sings a song to get the fishes, and the singing song that she sings is Sigaros. So the difficult
by Sigaros.
She sings a song by Sigaros. Yes.
Why?
Because she's a Selkie, or maybe she isn't, or maybe she is. Who knows? Now, look, the difficulty in doing this is that you have, all the way through, you have to keep the balance between is she, isn't she? Is she, you know, somebody just happened to...
Well, what was she doing in a net if she wasn't special?
But, Simon, that's the whole essence of the tale. Is she or isn't she?
Well, save me.
The little girl thinks she is.
It sounded a bit like Leap Year, and I don't...
It's nothing like Leap Year. Okay. Leap Year is like smacking your hand against the side of your face, right? This is like stroking the side of your face way which is nice but a little bit annoying. And overall, because we've got so little time,
30 seconds.
Okay, he manages to preserve the balance between is she or isn't she quite well. What he doesn't manage to do is get the balance between who is this for. Is this for an old audience? Is it for a young audience? Because it seems to lurch between being one kind of film and another kind of film. The music is much too close to being a local hero.
Yes.
But you know what? Maybe I'm just in a good mood this week. I was charmed even through the murk.
Movie of the week.
Oh, Legion.
With Paul Bettany.
With Paul Bettany.
Would you look at the time? It's nearly 3 o'clock. It's nearly 10 o'clock. You choose which you'd prefer. Hopefully next week we'll be back to normal.
I can't live at this speed.
Which would be very nice. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. That was a very good podcast this week.
What are we doing?
This is going to go at the end of the podcast. Okay, just run with it.
Oh, okay. Fine.
Did you enjoy the podcast this week, Mark?
I did enjoy the podcast this week.
Nice,
Simon,
to hear us all over again.
It was.
But if you are listening, you might be very frustrated, thinking, "Well, it sounds like you had a lot of fun with your visual versions of Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass."
Yes, I think we did have a lot of fun with that.
We will be releasing a movie version of that.
No.
Yes, probably on YouTube or something like that. Is that okay?
Yes, it's fine. Have you checked with Matt and Damon?
Matt and Damon and Paul and his friend Green.
Green and Grass.
And his mate Grass. Thanks very much for listening. Boy, it's been fun this week.
If strange.
Thank you and good night.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.